Welcome to the latest edition of the RBC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm talking with Dr. Brian Catchpole and Professor Sue Gregory of the RBC about their research into anal furunculosis in dogs. So Sue, can you start off by giving us an idea of what anal furunculosis is?
Well, anal furunculosis is a disease of dogs that affects the perineum and perianal mucocutaneous skin. It does have some other names. It's also known as perianal fistula, which is the term that's often used in America. But the two things are very interchangeable. It tends to affect mainly German Shepherd dogs, but not exclusively, but about 80% of the cases are German Shepherd dogs. Mm-hmm. And they're usually middle-aged dogs. So we usually see the disease at about 5 years old, but obviously there's a range, so some will be younger and some will be older. It's a disease that affects both sexes. Some papers have suggested it's more common in male dogs, but actually when you look at the range of literature, it affects males and females probably pretty much equally. Mm-hmm. And essentially what happens is these dogs get abscesses or little pinpoint discharging tracts in the perianal skin. And these can coalesce as the disease progresses to form really quite large ulcerated areas of skin loss. Mm. And sometimes there'll be quite deep tracts as well, running sort of in towards the animal, into the anus. And these may be associated with rectocutaneous fistulas in severe cases. The disease may be quite localised to one part of the anus, or it may be really extensive and, you know, you almost have a rotten bottom. The things that the owners tend to notice first are the dog licking the perineum, so licking underneath its tail. They may notice that the animal has a discharge from underneath its tail. So it may be that the fur's wet. A lot of these dogs have quite long hair. It may be that they notice a smell. And in more severe cases, the dog may have difficulty defecating, may actually have pain, be straining, may cry to defecate. It may become constipated. They may occasionally have diarrhea. And some of these dogs may well actually be generally quite unwell in themselves, so be lethargic, depressed, not willing to eat, and having, you know, general signs of being systemically unwell.
Yes, one can imagine it must be a very uncomfortable disease altogether, really. What are the standard treatment options we've got at the moment for anal furunculosis?
Well, I think what might be better really is to sort of give you a little bit of background in how things have developed, which probably will put the work that we've been doing into context and perhaps explain why we've got this fusion between a clinician, a surgeon, and a more basic scientist with Brian. But basically, when I was an undergraduate student, so it's a long time ago now, but the treatment essentially was antibiotics, local hygiene, so clipping the area, cleaning the area. There were descriptions of people using tail braces to elevate the tail, which is quite extreme. I never actually saw that, but I've seen pictures of it. But really, for the first 13 years of my career, so from the mid-80s, it was generally considered a surgical disease, and that was why I suppose I saw a lot of these cases as a small animal general surgeon. And there have been lots and lots of surgical treatments described, and what that immediately tells you is none of them work very well. Sure. When you've got lots of different treatments for the same disease. But generally surgery, regardless pretty much of the type of surgery that was employed, would result in quite a good, not brilliant, but sort of about 80% improvement in clinical signs in the short term. So things that were described surgically would be obviously traditional sharp dissection, but people in the 80s also used to freeze the abnormal tissues using cryosurgery. People also used to damage the tissues and get them to die in slough by using other modalities, so chemical cautery, electrical cautery, diathermy. Lasers have been employed. And The other thing is there were a variety of different mechanisms. Some, if with sharp dissection, then the wounds may or may not be primarily repaired. Sometimes it would be a small local piece of tissue that would be removed and then sutured up. Other times the whole perianal skin would be removed and then the rectum reanastomosed to the skin. Obviously, if a method of tissue destruction was used, then the wounds would be allowed to be left open and allowed to heal by second intention, which might take, you know, quite a considerable length of time.
Yes.
So I think the bottom line is that there were lots of different surgeries. Some of them weren't particularly nice. There are always problems with surgery, so there may be a lot of wound care or management of wound breakdown for owners to contend with. Obviously, that would be continuing discomfort for the dog, a prolonged healing process. And then there was also the risk of getting damage to vital structures, so damage to the anal sphincter, which could result in fecal incontinence, and also excessive healing and rectal stricture formation. Many of these animals required multiple procedures. So, I mean, this was, you know, not good for the dog and not really good for pet owners. And also, we have to remember that a lot of German Shepherd dogs are working dogs, so not really practical for highly trained and very valuable dogs that may be dogs working for the army or police dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So there were quite a lot of problems associated with surgery.
Yes, a cure has been pretty challenging to achieve generally.
Mm-hmm. So then things moved on, and then in the late sort of 90s, there was an interesting report, 1997, of cyclosporine being used, and that had a dramatic effect on the lesions that these dogs had. And really, that's kind of how our work got going. So I think the other thing is it's important to remember that although the way we treat these dogs has swung radically in the last 10 years or so, from being predominantly surgical to now being more of a medically managed disease, there actually still is a role for surgery. And really, these dogs may still benefit from removal of the anal sacs as part of management of the disease, removal of persistent lesions, and also when these lesions heal, often the healing is exuberant, and sometimes they need debridement to try and get them healing in a more sensible way. Often they heal with bridges of epithelialized tissue, actually over ulcers, so they can do with some tidying up. And then a few of them will have strictures which may need to be managed surgically. So unfortunately, they don't all escape the surgeon's knife.
Cyclosporine is an immunosuppressive drug, isn't it?
Yeah, it specifically interferes with T cell function, primarily blocks interleukin-2 production, so clonal expansion. It's a drug that was primarily used in transplantation in humans to prevent organ rejection, and has then been used quite substantially for treatment of immune-mediated disease in people. And so that's now being used in veterinary practice. So there's a licensed cyclosporine therapy now for dogs that we can use for immune-mediated diseases. So clearly the fact that anal frunculosis responded to cyclosporine meant that we started thinking that there was an immune-mediated component. So as a veterinary immunologist, that's when I started getting interested in the disease process.
Okay, so what is the pathological basis of anal frunculosis then? It's an immune-mediated disease then?
Well, I think that the fact that we see such good results with cyclosporine would give indirect evidence that there's a T-cell-mediated component. So this was really where we started off with doing some basic science on this disease and looking at the cytokine profile within biopsies that were being taken from these dogs. And Arthur House, who at that point was a surgical resident and who subsequently did his PhD on this, was taking quite a number of biopsies as part of the surgical management of these cases. And so we had material available that we could examine to see what the cytokine profile was like within the lesions. And there were some cases where they have a 4-week course of cyclosporine, but there's still residual disease at the end of that. And I guess that's where the surgeons then step in again and remove the residual lesions. So in some cases, we have pre and post cyclosporine biopsies to examine. And what Arthur found was that the biopsies taken from these animals as they presented very much showed a pro-inflammatory T helper type 1 profile of cytokines. So we were detecting really large amounts of interleukin 2 message and gamma interferon message and TNF alpha message. So that's fairly consistent with a T helper type 1 macrophage type interaction, leading to a pro-inflammatory environment within the tissues. And what we saw in the lesions after cyclosporine treatment was that that was very much suppressed, and we started to see a cytokine profile that looked more like wound healing. So we were seeing interleukin 10 and TGF-beta rather than interferon gamma and TNF-alpha. So those very early studies that Arthur did as a resident really sort of confirmed from a mechanistic point of view within the tissues what we suspected in terms of the animal's actual response to the drug.
Okay, so it's an inflammatory disease, clearly, and the drug is causing a more healing phenotype in terms of inflammatory molecules you're seeing anyway.
Yeah, it seems to be interfering with that pro-inflammatory T-cell response that's going on within the tissues. And as you know, the more things you answer, the more questions you have. So the question we then had was, well, why on earth are we having this inflammatory T-cell response going on in the tissues, and how can we possibly explain that from a pathological and mechanistic point of view? Which is where we started to, I guess, to draw on the Crohn's disease model.
Right.
So we normally use animal models to predict human disease, and actually what we did was the other way around. There's so much work been done on Crohn's disease that we looked at Crohn's disease as a potential model for anal funculosis, because the proportion of Crohn's patients do develop these perianal fistulae, and also dogs with anal funculosis, the pathology is not always just restricted to the perianal region. Some of these dogs have large bowel disease as well. It's just, you know, you can think of the lesions around the bottom as the tip of the iceberg, really. That
okay.
If you actually look deeper and look at the large bowel, you'll see similar types of lesions within the large bowel. And I guess that's really a contributing factor to these patients that do have diarrhea as well as anal funculosis. So there was quite a lot of similarity from the clinical point of view, from the therapy point of view, and the cytokine profile point of view as well, that the two diseases might be similar, although not necessarily identical, but similar pathological mechanisms involved in generating this type of immune-mediated pathology.
Yes, because obviously Crohn's disease is a chronic disease of the lower bowel in humans, and that is T-cell mediated inflammation as well, isn't
yeah,
it?
Absolutely.
Yes. So what is the molecular basis of the problems that we encounter with anal furunculosis? Because I understand you've looked into this in some detail.
Well, it's quite interesting, because I remember at uni being told that German shepherds have some kind of immune deficiency, because they suffer from a number of different syndromes that would suspect that the immune system's not functioning properly and is quite deficient. So they don't just get anal furunculosis, but they actually get inflammatory bowel disease,
right.
Which is primarily an inflammatory disease of the bowel. They also can get deep pyoderma, so inflammatory infectious processes going on in the skin. And they're also susceptible to systemic aspergillosis. So aspergillus is a fungus.
Mm-hmm.
It's present everywhere. And in other breeds, we tend to see that restricted to, when it causes pathology, it's restricted to rhinitis in the nose. But in Australia, they seem to see quite a lot of German shepherds where this becomes systemic and spreads around the body and causes granulomas in the viscera. So clearly, if we look at all the syndromes that German Shepherds get, it's suggested that there's an immune deficiency. And of course, as an immunologist, the last thing that you would give an animal with an immune deficiency is cytosporin, which right. is an immunosuppressive drug. So the response to therapy really turned things on its head, and we went from thinking that it was an immune deficiency to an immune-mediated disease, so a hypersensitivity disorder. But the more we looked into Crohn's disease, the more we started to think that actually it might be a combination of the two, that there's a primary deficiency of the innate immune system that leads to a hyperreaction of the adaptive immune system. Mm. So using the Crohn's disease model, a defect in a pattern recognition receptor called NOD2, which is one of the receptors the innate immune system uses to sense and detect bacteria, is deficient. And it seems that if you have an innate immune deficiency, then these local infections that are normally dealt with by the innate immune system actually compromise that. And so now the adaptive immune system has to get involved and actually overreacts. And so we end up with immune-mediated pathology in response to often fairly harmless organisms or even food antigens that are present at the mucosa. So we think that the model of Crohn's disease, which is a primary innate immune deficiency with a secondary immune-mediated pathology caused by T cells, fits quite nicely within funculosis. And so the question is can we actually define that a bit more closely? What is it that's defective in the innate immune system, and what is it that makes the adaptive immune system hyperactive? So clearly the two areas of research that we went into were immunological, so looking at macrophage responses in affected dogs to see how those macrophages' innate immune response would work, and looking at, as we were saying, look at cytokine profile, what the T cells are doing, but also look at things from the genetic level, because you know we find this in primarily in German Shepherd dogs. Leonbergers are the other breed that are potentially affected, and these two breeds are quite closely related, I think, aren't they, Steve?
Yes, and the other thing is that, you know, clinically, we actually sometimes had related dogs coming into the clinics. Mm. So not only were they German Shepherd dogs, but we knew that they were related as well, which also raised our suspicions.
So we work quite closely with the immunogenetics team at University of Manchester, who've done a lot of characterisation of canine immune response genes, right. Particularly MHC, so what we call the dog leukocyte antigen, or DLA. So one of the first things that they looked at using our samples was whether there was an MHC, a DLA gene association, and they found that in fact there was. So the DRB1 or 1 or 2 allele was associated with the disease, and what we found was that the dogs that were homozygous for that allele were more prone to develop AF when they were younger. So having two copies of that seemed to exacerbate and speed up the whole
right,
sort of process.
This is two copies of a gene which is involved, obviously, in
T cell responses.
It's a certain antigen.
That's right. It's the gene that encodes the MHC molecules, which are required to present antigen to T cells. So again, quite a nice fit with pathogenesis at a molecular and at a genetic level. So the homozygous genotype seems to be associated with AF, particularly to the extent that I think we had one control dog that was homozygous. We'd seen in the RVC for something else. The sample had been taken when the dog was quite young, so we got back to the referring veterinary surgeon just to ask them some questions, and he was quite amazed that we knew the dog had anal funculosis, because he just diagnosed it with anal funculosis, I think, a couple of months previously.
So it's very strongly predictive then?
Well, I wouldn't say strongly, yeah. but anecdotally, it's predictive. So that's clearly a potential mechanism for why the adaptive immune system becomes hypersensitive. So what we've also been looking at is the innate immune response gene, so NOD2 for example, which is the Crohn's mutation. We haven't so far found a mutation within NOD2, but the mechanism holds. It doesn't have to be the exact same gene, but one of the family of pattern recognition receptors, or a combination of defects in different pattern recognition receptors, could explain the similar pathology. So we've been looking at various toll-like receptors to see whether we can identify any polymorphisms that might be associated with the disease. And one of the problems that we have is that for many of the toll-like receptor genes, German Shepherd dogs are incredibly restricted in the number of alleles that they have. So whereas these genes are quite varied in the general dog population, within German Shepherd dogs, there may be one dominant allele. So doing a case control study in that scenario is actually quite difficult, because what it's suggesting is that a large proportion of the German Shepherd dog population carry a susceptibility gene, but because there's an environmental component and potentially a dietary component, a hormonal component, these non-genetic factors then determine whether that susceptibility genotype actually becomes clinical disease. So it's possible that every single German Shepherd dog on the planet has a defective toll-like receptor, but you need a combination of that with these various other external factors in order to get disease. So we weren't able to prove a link between any one of these receptors doing a breed-matched case control study, just because the whole population is so monomorphic. So we suspect that that's what's going on, that they have a particular pattern recognition receptor gene that predisposes them to this type of disease. And actually the phenotype that we see then is related to the environment that the animal's in. So if they make an inappropriate response to their gut bacteria, they might progress to inflammatory bowel disease. If they make an inappropriate response to their skin flora, they get deep pyoderma. If they make an inappropriate response to fecal organisms, then they get infunculosis. It's a nice idea, because it actually might explain not just infunculosis, but all the other syndromes that we see in the German Shepherd dog.
Yes, because these receptors are responsible for responses to various molecules associated with organisms.
Yeah. We didn't feel that the antiviral receptors were any such candidate, because there's no evidence out there that German Shepherd dogs are predisposed to viral infection. So we've concentrated on the receptors that were responsible for bacteria and fungal and yeast infections, because those seem to be the type of problem that they had. One of the other things that we did from a functional point of view is we weren't just looking at the genes, but we were actually looking at the function of the receptors on the cells. So Arthur was taking monocytes from the blood and growing these up into macrophages in the laboratory, and then adding different microbial components that signal through specific toll-like receptors and through NOD2 to see whether the response that we got from the cells was appropriate or not. So we were really trying to identify whether there was any ligand in particular where we had a deficient response. And what he found was that when we generated macrophages from affected German Shepherds, they didn't respond very well to myrmal dipeptide, which is the NOD2 ligand. So what we were seeing from the dog macrophages from affected dogs was pretty much the same as what you see in a Crohn's patient who has the NOD mutation. But we've looked at the NOD2 gene and we can't find an explanation for that. So it may be that it's not the actual receptor that's defective. It's another receptor that interacts closely with NOD2, or it's one of the signalling molecules involved in NOD2 signalling. From a cellular point of view, it does look like the macrophages from these affected dogs don't react appropriately to the presence of microbial components, which kind of fits with the hypothesis.
How do things stand at the moment in terms of your ongoing work and how you will recommend or handle treatment of dogs with anophoronchiolysis at the moment?
Rather than use a candidate gene approach, what we've decided to do in collaboration with Bilolia's group in Manchester was to do a genome-wide association study. So rather than pick on individual genes, we'd actually analyse the population at the genome, whole genome level. And that's identified a number of hits, a number of loci that are associated with the case population compared to controls. And Manchester are now in the process of fine mapping those loci to see whether we can narrow it down to a single gene. And then once that's done, then we'll actually focus in on that gene and try and identify any specific polymorphism or mutation that might be responsible. So I think that's probably going to identify the genetic factors that are involved. In terms of how does science feed into the clinic, I think one of the interesting things that Arthur found was that the macrophage activation profile in the lesions meant we were seeing a lot of expression of matrix metalloproteinase enzymes, and that fits with the ulcerative nature of the disease. So that's a target for therapy, really. And it may be that in those dogs that have severe ulcerative disease, we not only need cyclosporine to switch off the T cells, but we may need to use MMP inhibitors to try and switch off the macrophage response that's damaging a lot of the tissues.
And in terms of sort of, I guess, practicalities on a day-to-day basis, I think the work has been hugely helpful in terms of helping manage not only the dogs but also the owners. You know, I think that historically there was very much a hope that they would come, they would have a treatment, and the problem would be solved and resolved. And I think we now know that that's, you know, not likely to be the case. We understand that even if we're able to manage the disease locally, as soon as treatment is discontinued, there is always the chance of recurrence. Alongside a lot of the more scientific work, we've also been looking at cyclosporine. Other groups have been doing this as well. It's unclear, you know, what is the most appropriate dosing regime. Is cyclosporine alone enough? And I think increasingly, you know, there are problems with cyclosporine, not just in terms of potential side effect, but it's a hugely expensive drug. And if these animals are going to potentially need to be on some immunomodulatory drug long term, then that in itself is a very real concern.
And this would be given systemically then, certainly in some cases, if there are internal lesions, I guess.
I think the fistulous form, when Arthur looked at the disease profile, the dogs that had the fistulous disease tended to have the worst prognosis.
Mm.
So they often would come back and they would have to have the lesion resected. And clearly, if there's a nidus of infection all the way down the bottom of this sinus, for example, then that's very difficult to remove that. And even if we kill the bug, from an immunological point of view, you may still have the presence of antigen there. So it's not primarily an infection that's driving the pathology. It's actually the immune response to the presence of a particular bacterium. So it may be that, you know, antibiotics may do their job, but it's not actually stopping antigenic exposure to the immune system. So I guess the dogs that have sinuses and fistulae are the most problematic. If you look at some of the before and after pictures that Arthur had, some of the dogs that had the most horrendous external lesions, so incredibly ulcerated, tended to do very well. So, and the dogs that had often what looked like minimal disease were the ones that didn't really do very well and to some extent had the most pain and discomfort. Rather, you would have thought it was the other way around, but from Arthur's experience, it seemed the dogs with the sinus tracts and the fistulae were the ones that actually, from a clinical point of view, from a welfare point of view, were the biggest concern. So one of the ideas that we have is potentially drug delivery directly to the lesions, so the sinus tracts for example. And we've got a project potentially with UCL where they've got this delivery system of microspheres that you can load with drug, so cyclosporine or tacrolimus, that we could potentially administer directly into the sinus tracts, and that might actually do a better job than giving the immunosuppressive systemically.
So I think just going back to sort of managing these patients in the clinics, there's sort of a variety of things. I think at managing the owners and managing the dogs, the expectations, so long term, and remission is probably a better term than cure. And also thinking about what are the goals of treatment. I think that traditionally, if the animal still had lesions, it was considered a failure. I think that's perhaps not appropriate. I think what the goal should be is not necessarily complete resolution of lesions, although that's what we would like to see, but actually resolution of pain, straining, tenesmus. And if we still have one or two lesions, well, but actually they're not really causing the dog any clinical problem, I think that's something that we perhaps ought to consider a success. I think it's very important that we accept that there is a genetic basis for this, and that prevention is a lot better than cure, or even just trying to get remission. So I think that's a very important message, which I'm not really sure we've particularly articulated widely to the dog-owning public yet, but I think that's something that we need to do.
Prevention in this case would mean, therefore, advice against breeding from severely affected individuals, presumably.
Yeah.
I think the problem with a lot of these complex genetic disorders that manifest in middle age and later age is that often these animals have had litters.
Mm.
So you can't go back and stop that from happening. But certainly you can advise against that animal being used. And it may be that when we've finished the fine mapping and we've identified specific mutations, that we have several genes that we can potentially analyse and offer the owner a genetic profile for that animal and an associated risk of that animal progressing to anal frunculosis in the future. But it's not going to be a genetic test that breeders are used to. They're normally used to a test where it says this is a mutant animal, this is a carrier, this is a clear animal. And that's not the sort of test that we'd be thinking about. It'd be more a test to say, well, the average risk of a German Shepherd is such and such. And looking at the genotype of this animal, that risk is either increased or decreased, dependent upon which mutations they may or may not have. But this comes back to the problem where we've found that certain toll-like receptors are pretty much ubiquitous. The alleles are ubiquitous in the German Shepherd dog population. You clearly can't breed away from that, because if 95% of all German Shepherds carry that, then it's impossible to breed that out.
Okay, Brian and Sue, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
And thank you all very much for listening to this latest edition of the podcast. I hope very much you'll be back again next time. In the meantime, if you have any comments or suggestions with regard to the podcast, please feel free to email us at podcast@rbc.ac.uk. Thanks again.